Authors Over 50, Writing in Life's Sweetest Third. Authors Over 50's weekly podcast celebrates writers and their journeys to publication. Writing after 50 is a whole story on its own, so let's skip to Life's Sweetest Third and talk with authors about their journey from pen to publish. Welcome, I'm Julia Daly, your host, and I invite you to listen to interviews with writers who've achieved their goal of publishing a book just later in life. We've seen award lists for under 30 or under 40, but I've yet to see lists for those who've achieved a significant milestone of their own, launching a new career and publishing their first book after the age of 50. We will hear about these authors' inspirations, struggles, strategies, and the smell of that first book. These writers' journeys inspire me because I'm one of them. My guest today writes novels, plays, poems, and hybrid forms of fiction that explore the intersection of politics and culture. Some of her work is realistic. Some is experimental. Some of it is dystopian. Some is what I call reality fantasy. She's an award-winning journalist, playwright, and certified nonfiction book coach. Welcome to Authors Over 50, Amy L. Bernstein.
Thank you, Julia. I am really glad to be here with you today.
We're glad to have you. Amy, our opening question on Authors Over 50 is always, so what took you so long to write your first book?
I absolutely love that question. And it's true. I believe that I was in my early 50s, maybe, when I wrote my first book. And I had always promised myself that I would. I had started something in my 20s and abandoned it with a complete lack of confidence. You know, that sense, well, I can't do this. I don't know what I'm doing. I can't do this. And I returned 30 years later, not to the same book, but I returned decades later thinking, you know what? I need to do this. I want to do this. I'm going to do this. And once I committed to really finishing writing a novel, even though it wasn't that long, I realized, well, if I've done it once, someday I can do it again. So I was proud of getting over that hurdle.
Well, once you knew you had to write that book, how did you proceed? Did you search for an agent or decide to choose a hybrid or small press, or did you self-publish?
Well, this was a number of years ago, as I am way over 50 now. And so I was working a very stressful full-time job and raising a teenage daughter with my husband and commuting on a, this is all relevant to the question, and commuting on a train several hours a day. So I did a lot of the writing on the train and then I think on the weekends. And it was a young adult novel called Fran, The Second Time Around. And when I finished it at that time, I knew absolutely nothing about the publishing industry. Today, I know a great deal, but then I did not. And I didn't know what to do with it. And so self-publishing at that time, this was around 2007 or 8, was in its infancy. And some of these big companies were just coming on the scene, to take people's work. And they didn't do a great job. I mean, they designed an okay cover, but it was kind of crude, and they just wanted you to buy your own books. That's all they cared about. And so I did not really do much. I didn't really market the thing. I think I felt, oh my gosh, I did it. I wrote it. Here it is in my hands. Okay, that's great. And I kind of stopped. I just left it there. And I think I shared it with members of my family. However, fast forward to about 2020, early in the pandemic, I guess, maybe right before, and I was writing novels much more seriously and with much more ambition. And I consulted a publicist who said to me, well, you know, you really ought to reissue that. You've got that earlier novel. Why don't you bring that back out and, you know, let people know you've got a book out there? And I was skeptical, but I commissioned a new cover. I also commissioned an audiobook, and I reissued it, and I'm really glad that I did, because now it's legitimately now in my portfolio, even though it's the oldster of the bunch.
Well, you're quite prolific now because you've got two brand new novels coming out this summer. Tell us more about your inspiration for those.
That's right. I am a multi-genre author, and I kind of refuse to limit myself to one genre because it's so much fun to figure out a story you want to tell and decide the best way to tell that particular story. So, a week from now, my new paranormal romance called The Nighthawkers is going to be released. I'm very excited. I've gotten a lot of really nice advanced praise and comments for this book. It's a time traveling romance full of archaeology and artifacts, and it's kind of magical and lyrical, and I just love archaeology and talking about ancient objects and their beauty. And of course, there is a love interest, two love interests, in fact. So I had to follow some of the conventions of romance, but that's just been a delight to talk about. And so that book absolutely is available on pre-order now and can be bought, on Amazon, Kobo, and Barnes and Noble, and wherever you would think to look for a book. Tremendous fun. And then in early August, Regal House Publishing is bringing out The Potrero Complex, which is a post-pandemic mystery thriller. So at its heart, it's a mystery. And I really did conceive of it early in the pandemic and created a society in the near future where we're coming out of an experience far worse than even than the one that we've been withstanding, and looking at how that affects society and people's thinkings about safety and social justice and civil rights. But as I say, it's really also a mystery. So I like to get a lot of things in there.
Certainly sounds quite relevant for our time right now. And for our listeners who might be listening to this podcast in the future, we're talking about her books being published in the summer of 2022. There's so many books out there. We're told that 2,000 books a day publish in the US, over 1 million books a year. How do you think that we can each make ours different enough so that people want to read our books?
Julia, that is a question that I and thousands of unknown and independent authors are wrestling with every single day. And it's a very important question because I think at the end of the day, you just need to try to engage with real readers, with real human beings, even if that's low numbers, because real engagement with readers where you're having a genuine exchange of ideas and views and opinions, you can't do that on the basis of thousands and thousands. Like you can say, well, I've got thousands of followers on social media, but that's not always real. And so I just think that the emerging author or the indie author has to focus on engagement, even on a small scale, and do whatever you can to try and help people fall in love with your book or your books or who you are as an author. But really, I just read a quote from Alessandra Torre, who's a bestseller and very active in supporting other writers. And she basically said, don't worry about how you're going to sell a lot of books, because the truth is you probably won't. And that's not meant to discourage authors, although we can feel that way. It's meant to remind us that, at the end of the day, that's not the thing we should be chasing. If you can find that one reader who just really fell in love with your work and really responded, I mean, that's very rewarding. Not that we should only have one reader.
Well, I love to get inside the heads of those of you who write in so many different genres, especially those of you who create fantasy worlds. And so I always wonder, how do you determine the plots of your books?
Well, I find, and I have a fantasy coming out in September, about a half, someone who's half human and half mermaid. I find that for me, I think a lot of authors might say, well, I do a lot of very careful, detailed world building, and that's all fine. I really think it starts with the character and the character's needs and wants and their conflict. and also their arc of change in the book. How does this character grow and change? And what journey do we take the reader on with that character? I think if you start there, it doesn't matter what genre you're in. You could do that in a fantasy just as well as you can in a horror story, a comedic novel, a mystery, etc. And so that's the point I always come at. And as I write more and more, I find that that's what I need to do. I need to understand who are these people that I'm writing about, and where is their point of pain, and where is their inflection point to change, and the rest you can build everything around that.
Well, our listeners often tell us that their favorite segment of our podcast is listening to the authors read their own work. So please tell us about which book you've decided to read to us today, and then read a section so we can hear your voice and tone in the book.
Thank you, Julia. I love doing this. I'm going to read you just really the first page and a half from The Potrero Complex. This is the mystery thriller that is coming out from Regal House Publishing on August 2nd. It concerns a journalist named Rags Goldner, who is pretty burned out from covering the pandemic and has moved with her partner to a small town, hoping to escape some of the complexities of life and lead a simpler life. But of course, that is not to be. That simpler life is not to be found. So I'm going to read you the very beginning, and you're going to know right away that things in this small town are perhaps not as they seem. Here we go. Missing. A teenaged girl with lanky blonde hair and a sunburst tattoo on her cheek. The holographic posters, brighter than day itself, lit up the air on every block of Main Street. They were the first thing Rags Goldner noticed as she and her partner, Flint Sten, arrived in Canary. The girl's name was Effie, and she was 16. Effie's pixelated image beamed down at Rags like a celebrity unaware that her 15 minutes of fame were up. Rags refused to give a damn about the missing girl, who, after all, she didn't know, nor did she know how much about the town, Canary, where the driverless share car she and Flint had leased for their move had brought them. But missing kids make news. And as Canary's newly imported one and only newspaper editor, Rags knew she'd be expected to do something about it, which meant she wouldn't control the news hole on day one, which meant all kinds of people would come at her to do one thing or another. Rags hadn't been in town 5 minutes, and already she could tell things were going to get complicated. And complicated was the very thing she and Flint were trying to get away from. Damn all the politicians and peacekeepers and their gatekeeping bullshit, she thought. As the car made a final turn toward its programmed destination, Rags's twitch flared up. The muscles in her upper left cheek and the outer corner of her left eye performed an uncontrolled little dance. Ah, crap, she said. Turning Main Street into Times Square won't help them find the girl. What a waste. And all that light pollution. She stretched her face, willing the twitch to stop. Flint held up his dataphone and aimed it at one of the digital posters as they cruised by. The static image of Effie sprang into augmented reality motion. She turned her head, blinked, and laughed. Stop doing that, Flint, Rags said. Just don't. No way that girl out there somewhere is smiling. Don't get spun up so fast. Flint looked over at her for the first time in hours. Their connection was like a faulty wire fritzing on and off. Give yourself some room to ramp up, he said, putting his hand on top of her head in a familiar gesture. Simmer down. It helped. The twitching nearly stopped. We haven't even come to a full stop yet. Pace yourself. Well, look, Rex said. They've plastered her face everywhere. Probably been like that for weeks. You think the story about this girl has gone cold, right? Flint said. What do you call that? Beat up. I'm guessing the story's beat up. The first thing I'm going to hear is that they want me to flog it some more. Remind me, why are we doing this? Let's not, Flint said, looking back down at his screen. Anyway, it was your idea. As the share car rolled noiselessly down Main Street, Rags saw just one person hanging around the deserted downtown, a woman standing on a corner who appeared to be waiting. For what? Rags wondered. As they slowly passed by, Rags caught a dead look in the woman's eyes. A block further on, Rags watched a man and a woman, both in shabby coats, as they appeared to argue, their faces contorted with anger. The man handed the woman a bicycle pump. She handed him in return a loaf of bread. What kind of town is this? Stop there.
Wow, Amy, that is so descriptive. We can certainly tell why you're an award-winning journalist, because that had us right there in the scene.
I hope so.
How long on average does it take you to write a book? Because you've got three coming out now.
Each one has been really different. And I hate to admit that I seem to write pretty fast, because I've learned, well, fast can be wonderful, but not always. When I fast, I mean like six months, which is very, 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 very fast to write a novel, or at least a first complete draft. The more I write now, the more I'm slowing down, because I feel more compelled to find out how to sort of deepen the story and really pay attention to pace and cadence and, you know, what's each scene really doing. And so I'm getting a lot more, I guess, analytical, but in a good way. I think what I'm talking about is that I'm trying to get better at the craft. And when I knew less and was just writing, if you're a lifelong reader, as I am, you know what a book sort of sounds like, kind of. Gets into your bones. But then you start writing, and you still don't know much about the craft of writing. You just write. And I definitely started out that way with my first couple of books. And now I'm like, whoa, let's take a step back here. What's really going on? What's our intention? What are we really doing? And that has slowed me down a lot. So I think going forward, we're going to be more like I'd be lucky to sort of complete a first draft in a year type situation.
Well, that's still very quick to write a novel. I don't know if you've ever taken the NaNoWriMo challenge.
It's
very fast. I tried it for the first time last year, and 1,667 words a day to get 50,000 words in 1 month is fast writing.
That is really fast. I think it works if you are extremely clear on your story and if you're extremely clear on your genre. I think because genre, when you're really adhering to genre, it's giving you clear tropes and beats, and if you understand what those are and how to hit them, then it can be done. I'm getting to the point where I'm trying to write so-called literary fiction, not to sound pretentious. It's just that it's complicated, and there's no way I couldn't pump out that kind of copy on that. But I'm incredibly impressed by all the writers who do.
Well, when you have to do research on topics that you're going to write about, do you complete your research before you begin writing or as you go along?
That is a great question, because I do a lot of research for all of my books, and it really comes out of my journalism background. I bring a lot of fact into my fiction, and it's not just so-called verisimilitude, you know, should that street corner really look or whatever. It's just sort of about trying to take the real world and then offset it just a bit, but I want that world to be very real. I do a lot of research in the beginning, and then I will stop and fill in as needed. And on the paranormal romance, which is full of archaeology and archaeological digs and digging up artifacts, I did a tremendous amount of research, not just on real archaeological excavations and real artifacts, which I loved that research because I love that topic so much. So poring over, you know, Antiquities Journal and Archaeology Magazine, all that stuff is a pleasure. But I also had to learn what are some of the tools in archaeology that people use. And so I could throw around some words. and my characters knew what they were doing. So I love the research, and I keep finding where my holes are. In the Potrero complex, one of the smartest decisions I made was I interviewed two real people. I interviewed an archaeologist for the Potrero complex as well, because there's a smattering of archaeology in it, even though it's not the main plot point. It doesn't drive the story, but I needed some key location information. And then I also interviewed someone who is a professional computer programmer and software developer to learn more about the work life and tools and mindset of that person, because Flint Sten, who you just heard from, who's Rag's partner, is in that world. And I wanted him to seem very believable. And that was incredibly helpful.
Well, your character names are unique, and I'm always interested in how an author chooses their character names. How do you go about that process?
Sometimes they literally announce themselves to me just lickety split and I stick with it. Sometimes I really have to dig and think about it, and I'll change them many times before I'll alight on something. And so sometimes it's fast and sometimes it's not so fast. And once I'm there, I can't even remember what the other options were. It's kind of like, you know, when you have a kid and you're coming up with all the baby names and you get this long list and maybe you love them all, but then once you have that baby and you name it, I think you may forget most of the names on your list because it's not even real anymore. So once they're named, I don't know what they were, might've been named. I do believe that the sound of a name should say something subtle about the character. And I mean, I think some people take that very far. You know, like in a comic novel, you'll have like funny names, like, you know, Humperdinkle or something that's just funny. But like with Rags, her real name is Polly, which you find out, but Rags has a very hard edge to it. And that was very deliberate.
Well, I know that when we get to the editing stage, our editors sometimes have told me that my character's names are too similar to, you know, one in the Hunger Games or something like that. So I've had to change those midstream because they're too familiar. And of course, I'm not as familiar with all of those genres, but that's interesting when we get our head set about a name and then we have to change those. It becomes more difficult to know our character.
Was that painful for you, Julia? Did it take you a while to make that switch?
It really did.
Oh, and I can imagine.
I could see the character and her name in the scenes. And then after that, I had to say, now, wait, what's her name again?
Right.
So it does take you out of your comfort zone there for a little while.
Yes, I did. The book that's coming out in September, which is, I call it a political fantasy. I've just created that as a subgenre, just, you know, but I did very late in the game change a minor character's name and his entire, he plays an important role, his entire background of where his parents come, because he's a first generation American, because it was very important to the story about where he came from and how it shaped his worldview and how that affected the main character. So there's this little ripple effect going on. And when I realized something erroneous, which I just don't need to go into, I realized, oh no, he can't be, his family can't be from here. They have to be from here. And I had to change everything. And so it took me quite a while to think, wait, Nate? Who's Nate? What? It's like, oh, renamed him.
Being reacquainted with our own characters.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, Amy, are you writing full time now? Or are you still working out in the workplace?
I do have the privilege and the luxury to be writing full time. And I find that I don't think at this point I could be very effective if I were still working full time. And I mean, all the writers who get up at 4 or 5 in the morning or who find those snatches, I mean, I guess that's what I used to do, because I also wrote quite a number of plays while I was still working full time. And I guess that is what I did. And I stole time on the weekends when I could. But the luxury of being able to structure my days both around the writing and book marketing and book coaching is an honor, a privilege, and a pleasure.
Tell us more about your book coaching. I'm sure there are a lot of listeners out here who desire a book coach. What actually do you do to help writers?
Well, my fellow coaches and I wish that every aspiring fiction and nonfiction writer could work with a book coach. I am certified by Author Accelerator, which is really the nation's leading provider of very stringent training in what it means to become a book coach. And we have at our disposal a number of tools and practices. Unlike an editor, because many people think, well, that's just a fancy word for an editor. And that's not true. An editor is really, really working a lot with the words on your page. The book coach is pulling back from that and helping you as an author on a fuller journey what is this work really about? Who is your ideal reader? What is the arc of change in this story? What's the voice that you're going to really develop and use? Why do you want to tell this story? Why now? It's a lot about really excavating the structure of your story and figuring out how it's really going to progress and creating a scaffold. And so we hold authors accountable that we work for, we work with, we create structure around the writing process and take them through steps that really is a self-discovery process about the book and about yourself as a writer. And it's the kind of support that every author deserves, because you're not in the wilderness anymore. Your book coach will both be your champion, but also provide you guardrails and tools for kind of getting through that thicket of the writing process. And it's just wonderful. I'm working with some clients now on the nonfiction side, and it's incredibly exciting to see how I can help them really, really achieve greater clarity in what they want to write about. Because at the outset, almost every author is very excited about their book or their project, and that excitement often masks a real lack of clarity and focus. You're just excited, and because you're excited, you assume you're going to get it done. But then there's a myriad of questions and decisions that you have to make to really get the words on the page in the correct order. And that's where Book Coach can really help you through that process.
Well, that's so interesting. And I love your word champion. We all need a champion on our side. So thank you for sharing that information. Are you able to coach yourself through your own projects, or do you need a book coach to help you with that?
I could turn the tools on myself. And in fact, Jenny Nash, who is the founder of Author Accelerator and sort of book coach extraordinaire, has now written two books, one for fiction and one for nonfiction, that can help an author see how to work their way through a very structured blueprint process. However, not surprisingly, we in the book coaching world will hasten to add that it's not really meant to be a self-directed process. It really is meant to be collaborative, because you as the writer, you just can't see what you can't see. The book coach is there to help give you some greater clarity of purpose and focus, and point things out to you that you may not see. So these tools are meant to be used more in a sort of a team collaborative setting.
Well, it's kind of like doing our own editing. You know, I can see all of your mistakes if you want me to read your advanced reader copy, but I can't see my own after I've looked at it for so long.
So true. So true. I know that, and you've probably done this too. I've taught myself to be a better self-editor. I've just taught myself to create at least a film of some distance. Because now that I've been edited well, I've also been edited badly, but I've been edited well, and I say, oh, that's what she's doing. Oh, I see why she's asking me to do that. So now I try to go into my own work and see, I try and get the jump.
Yes. I think the more we write and the more we're edited, the more we can do that for ourselves.
Yes.
You're so very busy, Amy, and you have so many different irons in the fire, as my Southern daddy would say. Do you make time to read? And if so, what genres?
I do love reading for pleasure, and I continue to gravitate toward, I guess, again, we just call it literary fiction. Mostly I don't tend to, even though I'm writing in genre fiction, I don't tend to read in genre fiction for the most part. I read American authors, certainly, but I've really read a fair amount of Southeast Asian authors and authors that claim multiple countries, some of the Nigerian authors that are writing today in English. I mean, I try to read across cultures. I don't get to all of them. And I will find that I have found that, and some book coaches and I were bemoaning that when we try to read for pleasure now, we're constantly analyzing, both as writers and coaches, we're analyzing. I see you nodding. We're analyzing the book, and it can take you a little bit out of the how did the author do this? Why did the author do that?
It really does change reading for pleasure.
It does.
What about marketing? You know, so many of our authors do not like to market themselves. Have you found anything that works for you?
I'm doing an all of the above approach, but not in a helter skelter sort of way. You know, I, like so many of us of this certain age, you know, I've had to teach myself social media and how it works and how to use the different channels. And there's still things I don't know how to do, but I definitely know all the basics. I make a lot of my own graphics that I put on social media. I built my own website. I have been, I'm learning how to try to do some email marketing through that website, which is tricky. I also have engaged a really fantastic publicist to help me in particular with the Potrero Complex. And she's been great. Like where should we submit for reviews? I also have paid for, what they call a virtual book and blog tour, which is a really popular thing now. I did that for the romance because that's a very popular thing to do with that kind of a book. And that's been wonderful because you get reviews, engagements, and posts way beyond what you could do on your own. So it's a great strategy to augment. I also, and I try and keep up an author blog, which I do very irregularly. I also, that blog also goes on to Goodreads. My Goodreads giveaway for the Nighthawkers, the romance, ends tomorrow, in fact. And so I do have almost 2,300 people signed up for the giveaway, which is respectable. So it really is an all of the above strategy. And I think I feel that as long as what I'm doing makes sense, I'm not trying to do stuff that's absolutely meaningless. I'm investing my author marketing dollars where I think I'll get the most bang for the buck and learning as I go, you know, what works, what doesn't. What do you think? Does that sound like crazy or?
No, I think that's exactly what all of us are doing in it. When we're trying to, you know, reflect on what we're spending and where we're placing that. And does that move the needle any, you know, for book sales? We just aren't sure a lot of the times. Do you know what the best money you've ever spent as a writer has been?
I think I'm going to say for right now that two things, the publicist that I've hired, and some publicists are very expensive. Mine is really much more on the modest end of the spectrum, which is great. That's really money well spent. If you find someone who, what she's done for me is, she's helped me talk about the word guardrails. I use that in book coaching. She's helped me put guardrails up. I was almost panicked. Like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do first. I don't know what I should ignore. I don't know what I should. She was like, here's what we're going to do. So she helped me come up with a really executable game plan. That's just brought so much sanity and calm to the book marketing process. So that's been money well spent. I also will say that, buying a Goodreads giveaway for $119 at first blush seems ridiculous. And that is really money well spent because, as you're sure you know, those thousands of folks who have entered my giveaway, they will all get an email when this book is available for publication. And as I keep saying, you know what? If 50 of those people bought the book, I would consider that a win. You know what else has turned out to be really good? I experimented with a $15 Facebook ad. I put $15 into a really simple Facebook ad when I launched the Goodreads giveaway. And it was clear that I had the book cover. It was clear that it was a paranormal romance giveaway. I got a lot of engagement for that. I think a lot of people went and signed up on the giveaway for $15. So that worked, I think.
Well, you can't beat that. Well, as we come to the end of our podcast today, we always like to ask if you have any advice for writers 50 and above.
You know, I really do feel that as we get older, we get the perspective that we need on what it means to take risk and what the rewards mean when we take those risks. And we bring so much to it as we get older. And there's so much to be said for not being the 22-year-old wunderkind, right? I really think there is. We bring so much life experience to our fiction or even to our nonfiction. And I would just strongly encourage everyone over 50 to definitely start that journey, because you'll never regret making it, no matter where you end up.
I think that's great advice, Amy. And tell our listeners where they can find you on social media.
Well, everything you need to know is on my website, and that's pretty easy. It's amywrites.live. It's Amy, A-M-Y, the word writes, WRITES.live, L-I-V-E, amywrites.live. I've got information and links on all my books. It's a little bit of information about the book coaching. Everything is there.
Well, thank you so much, Amy, for being with us. And we're so excited that you're now one of our authors over 50.
Julia, thank you so much. You ask fantastic questions, and I really loved the conversation.
Thank you for joining us today. Please look for Authors Over 50 every Thursday, when we will have conversations with accomplished debut novelists over the age of 50. Please subscribe and share with a friend. And check out my own publication journey after 50 at www.juliadaily, that's D-A-I-L-Y, like daily newspaper.com. Until next time, keep reading and writing. And remember, it's never too late to fulfill a dream in life's sweetest third.